welcome once again to the psychedelicparenting.org podcast. I am your host, Jonathan, and this is our fifth episode in my promised one episode a week Lenten vow. Only one more week to go. I wanted to start today by thanking Annie Oak, Maria Mangini, and everyone at the Women's Visionary Congress who made the Psychedelic Parenting Away team feel so very welcome at their New York salon this past weekend at the Alchemist's Kitchen. It was also a great honor to finally meet Dr. Judy Holland and Allison and Alex Gray in person, and to hear Allison give her talk entitled Psychedelic Family Business. We also had a great time with Catherine McLean and Francis, and with the Symposia crew at their Visionary Women storytelling event at Hellphone in Brooklyn on Saturday night. This place is a great venue. And if Symposia ever comes to your town, I heartily recommend attending one of their events. We would like to personally thank Lex P. and Catherine V. for opening their home to us at the Slow House and giving us a free place to stay for the weekend. We would also like to thank Thomas B. for his generous donation to our future growth, and to everyone who threw in a few dollars for stickers and posters which contributed to the gas money home. We couldn't have done it without your help. And a special thank you to my parents for watching the kiddos while we drove to New York for the weekend. In other news, Psychedelic Parenting is being featured this week in a premier edition article for the new media outlet Prime Mind. Prime Mind describes themselves as a media platform for exploratory journalism through the lens of the human psyche, and their focus is to create a meeting place where people not only read the news, but where a robust conversation about the topics can begin. You can find the site at primemind.com, and we'll see our article prominently featured in the Society section or at the top of the front page. Or you can also find a link directly to the article in the program notes to this podcast. Please view the article, link to it, and start a conversation about the work we are doing there. Don't forget that if you're in Southern Oregon, I will be speaking at the third annual Exploring Psychedelics Conference at Southern Oregon University in Ashland on April 7th and 8th. I will be participating in a three-way panel on cannabis, with my contribution highlighting books that can be used as conversation starters with your kids regarding cannabis. There is no cost to get into the event, and the amazing lineup of speakers includes our good friends Martin Ball, Matt Vogel, Baba Kalindi E.E., Harmony Haney, John Harrison, Steve Elfrink, and many others. This is not to be missed. Finally, if you like this work and feel called to help, consider a tax-deductible donation to Psychedelic Parenting through our fiscal sponsor, MAPS, via the donate button on the program notes. If we reach our $2,000 goal, we can get an additional $2,000 matching gift from Robert Barnhart. This money will be used to implement our forum functionality, improve the website look and feel, give us the ability to offer honorariums for content contributors, and upgrade our recording equipment. We are deeply grateful to all of you who have already given to the cause. Now, I would like to welcome to the show Maggie Volpo. Maggie is a writer and cannabis activist and a fellow Michigander. That means we live in Michigan. She has dual degrees in English and Spanish and has worked in traditional publishing, journalism as a blogger, and in the medical field as a translator. When she isn't fighting the tyranny of cannabis prohibition or working on her science fiction novels, she can be found sorting her neighbor's recyclables. She also loves to cook, bake, garden, knit, sew, and climb trees, the last of which is a joy shared by her son. Maggie is also the author of a series of children's books entitled Stinky Steve Explains Medical Marijuana. In the books, the titular green skunk reassures kids about their loved one's cannabis use and reminds them that it is a medicine and should be respected. Each book ends with the delightful rhyme, "Remember Stinky Steve's safety plan, don't touch the meds, and don't tell the man." The series is now in its fifth title and includes such topics as Daddy's Dabs, Mommy's Medibles, and Grandma's Grow Room. All the titles are available on Amazon.com via the link in our program notes. Maggie also makes these titles available for free in digital form to families with financial hardship who would benefit from them, and her contact info can be found in the program notes. Maggie is also the editor of the feminist cannabis publication Ladybud, a former cannabis dispensary owner, and a mother of a three-year-old son. We apologize for the lower sound quality in certain parts of this interview. Maggie was speaking to us via cell phone from rural Michigan, and her reception was impaired a few times. We have done our best to enhance the audio quality wherever possible. Welcome to Psychedelic Parenting, Maggie. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. So why don't you start out by telling us a little bit about yourself, how you started on this path, and how you got inspired to write about Stinky Steve?
Okay. Well, to start with, I came to cannabis itself after college as an alternative therapy to deal with my long-term depression and insomnia and undiagnosed PTSD. It's worked better than any other drug that's been prescribed to me.
Mm-hmm.
And after a few years, when medical marijuana became legal in the state of Michigan, my then-husband and I decided to invest in starting a dispensary. And while we were operating the dispensary, we worked a lot with families that had small children, and it was disturbing in a way to see how many of them were hiding their cannabis use, even if it was for really severe medical conditions like epilepsy, because they were worried about what their kids would say about it.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually the idea for Stinky Steve came from that, in that we needed some way to help parents talk about what could be a very difficult and confusing subject with young children in order to both educate the child and protect the family unit against unnecessary outside involvement
mm-hmm.
by child protective services or law enforcement. And yeah, so that's basically where Stinky Steve and his current form came from.
Mm-hmm. Right on. And
after the first book was produced, it became very obvious that one kind of blanket book that just talked about medical cannabis didn't touch on all of the various safety issues and niches of the market that exist.
Mm-hmm.
So it expanded into a series eventually. So we talk about multiple different topics from concentrates to children who use cannabis for severe medical conditions.
Right on. Yeah. And so how many books do you have out now?
We have 8 titles in print currently.
That's really exciting. And are those self-published or have you published them through someone else?
They are self-published and thus they are available on Amazon and DN.com. And we also try to make free copies available to anyone who wants them because we understand that a lot of people, especially those facing legal issues, can't always afford them.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone who emails us at info@stinkysteve.com can get access to free digital copies online to read and possibly share with their children if they feel appropriate.
Right on. Yeah, we Maggie sent us a review copy of the first book and read it with the kids, and everybody they thought it was very funny. They really thought that the ending part about don't touch the meds and don't tell the man was just, they were just thought that was a riot.
That, I mean, it was meant to be funny, but it was also meant to, you know, rhyming is a great way to kind of stick something into someone's brain, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And so by making the Stinky Steve safety plan of don't touch the meds and don't tell the man makes it easier for the kids to remember the two most important points, which are they shouldn't be touching or using their parents' cannabis. And they shouldn't be talking to anyone about it unless their parents have already said that that person is okay to talk about it with.
Yes, that's great advice. And very similar to the advice that we've given on this show before regarding other kinds of sacred medicine use. So yeah, that's great. Nice work.
Well, thank you. You know, we're all about helping people be safe,
mm-hmm.
you know, in something that they're doing already, either recreationally or medically, especially medically, because there's a lot of social stigma attached to it, and having those safety measures in place in your home kind of helps disarm some of that stigma.
Yeah.
Take it apart.
And there is a lot, there's a lot of pressures out there for people, especially, you know, patients, cannabis patients, there's a lot of pressures out there on their family units. I mean, we've seen so much stuff here in the state of Michigan, and we have, you know, there's some very visible activists out there, like in Kansas, Shona Banda, and, you know, we've just seen people in our own communities here in Michigan who have lost their kids just because they're patients for no other reason.
Absolutely. And it's horrifying. You mentioned here in Michigan, and I don't know if you're referencing specifically Steve and Maria Green
yeah.
and their daughter Bree.
Yep.
That case is just atrocious. And it's also a perfect example. Steve has a severe medical condition. I actually interviewed him before Bree was taken out of their custody, just about how the court had ordered him to stop using cannabis because he has epilepsy. He developed it as an adult, and he started having grand mal seizures, which are very debilitating, and he was severely injured. The courts actually ordered him to stop using the only medication that had ever suppressed his seizures then took his daughter out of their home anyway while he was complying with that court order.
And what was their reason?
The reason that the judge gave for taking the child, or I guess it wasn't a judge, you know, it was family court. The reason that they gave in the courtroom was that having a medical marijuana grow in the home meant that the house was more likely to be broken into and that it put the kids in the house at unnecessary risk of being murdered.
Wow.
Yes. Well, wow. Eventually, obviously, that was, it took a little bit over a month, maybe 2 months. I'm not recalling exactly right now, but the courts did return Bree to her parents, but she was an infant. She was nursing. You know, she was a breastfed baby at this point. And her mother, by the way, was testing clean for cannabis. She was not using and breastfeeding.
They
took this tiny baby away from her parents because her parents were growing the medicine that kept her dad from having seizures.
That state law legally allows him to grow and use.
Yeah.
Wow.
And theoretically, the law specifically has part of it written to protect parents against custody issues just because of their medical use.
Mm-hmm.
That the medical marijuana itself cannot be the sole determining factor for custody, and yet it was in their case, even temporarily.
And do you see things like that, these kinds of things increasing, or do you think that things are getting better?
I think that it's kind of getting a little bit worse, to be honest, because people are more open now about the cannabis use than they were a decade ago, you know, and there's social media, which makes it really easy to share things like, oh, here's a shot of me in my garden.
Yeah.
And, you know, you never know who's in your friends list or who your friends might be friends with who see it when your friend likes it. And so I do think there's been a minor uptick. I know that the statistics in the state of Michigan for asset forfeiture have gone up and arrests for cannabis have gone up since medical marijuana was passed in the state. So it wouldn't surprise me to find out that child removals have also gone up, although DHS and CPS don't have mandatory reporting laws, so there's no clear-cut statistics on that.
So tell us a little bit more about you. And specifically made you decide to be an activist?
It was seeing what was happening to other people in the community, quite frankly. And it was meeting parents, or sometimes not meeting, but just interviewing them for Ladybud, children needed access, or children had died waiting for medical access to cannabis. For me, one of the big and most important issues about cannabis legalization is getting access for pediatric epilepsy patients who, you know, kids with intractable epilepsy are a tiny fraction of the population, but they're also, you know, they die so young and so unexpectedly. Just earlier this week, actually, 2 days ago, Cindy Mae Meehan, a little girl in May whose parents were trying to get her access to medical cannabis in their home state, passed away from a seizure just out of the blue when they thought they had it more or less under control.
What was the name of the person?
Cindy Mae Meehan. She's just a little girl. Her mom is Susan Meehan. She's an activist out on the East Coast. And she's just one of many. I'm sorry, I'm kind of getting a little emotional here.
That's fine.
It breaks my heart. I hear about parents with terribly ill children who are desperate to do anything when traditional medication isn't working for their child, and they're being either turned into criminals for what they're doing, or they choose to try to change the law without breaking it, and some of them lose their children during that fight.
Right, yeah.
So that, to me, is a big driving factor, you know, helping to destroy the stigma around medical cannabis, especially around childhood use of medical cannabis, so that these kids can have safe access.
Yeah, right on. So tell us about Ladybud Magazine, how you got started with that, and what kind of things does Ladybud talk about?
Well, I discovered Ladybud Magazine a few months after our dispensary closed. And I honestly was just reading online, and someone I knew had shared one of their articles. And the more I read on their site, the more in love with the content I became, you know, and eventually I started writing for them and then worked as the editor. Although we're on hiatus now, I'm hopeful that we'll be back in publication again soon. It was founded by Diane Fornbacher, who has been a well-known national-level activist in the cannabis legalization community since the 90s. And it's all about, you know, spreading the word about the safe use of cannabis and feminism, you know, and it's specifically showing that women use cannabis and mothers use cannabis. And a lot of the content even focuses on female-specific cannabis use, like cannabis for endometriosis. We have multiple articles about that. And endometriosis is a debilitating, painful condition for the women who have it. And cannabis can help alleviate the pain symptoms and quite a few of the other secondary symptoms that come with endometriosis.
So what is that condition?
Endometriosis, the most basic way to explain it is the woman's uterus every month develops a lining that it basically becomes like the sac around the baby. If you become pregnant, and if you don't become pregnant, then that nutrient-rich layer sheds, which is what a woman's menstruation is.
Right.
And endometriosis, that lining develops outside the uterus on other organs.
Oh, wow.
Yes. It wreaks havoc on the body's hormones. It can ruin digestive processes. It's very, very painful for some people. To the point where they can't even get out of bed. And it's not very commonly talked about because it's a female health condition.
Sure.
Although they say that as many as 1 in 20 women can develop it during their lifetime while they're of reproductive age. So it's not an uncommon condition, but there aren't very many treatment options for it currently. And that's one of the things I love about Ladybud, is that they kind of kick open these doors that are kind of culturally shut to us and say, no, we are going to talk about this. We're not just going to talk about the squishy women parts. We're also going to talk about how cannabis helps for this thing that no one will let us talk about.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing. And, you know, how are the authorities in the medical, the sort of mainstream medical world, how do you think that they are responding to the growth in interest and in legality in different states of medical cannabis?
I think on an individual level, a lot of doctors know that it works and even support the expansion of medical marijuana programs. But on a larger scale, like on a professional scale, many of them have their hands tied by their malpractice insurance companies. Wherein they cannot write recommendations for medical cannabis without losing their insurance and thus their ability to practice medicine.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of doctors out there who, if federal prohibition was lifted, would be willing to write cannabis prescriptions or recommendations, cannot or will not do so currently because of federal prohibition and its effect on malpractice insurance laws.
I think there's also organizational rules for example our own family doctor. She is, you know, very much pro medical marijuana and has said so. My wife is a cannabis patient and has said so to her, but she's not, you know, she has had to sign a form. All of the doctors who belong to the hospital that she's affiliated with had to sign a document saying that they wouldn't write referrals for any of their patients.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is a shame, even though the doctors know that it works or acknowledge at least that it has great promise for helping.
Yeah. And it also, you know, it also creates a situation where it keeps the medicine on this sort of like alternative track. So like, for example, the person that I interviewed last week, Maria Mangini, she's a nurse practitioner, and she shares a practice with a guy named Dr. Frank Lucido, who is a graduate of the University of Michigan. Their practice is in Berkeley, but they have a regular family medical practice where they also incorporate cannabis as just like another part of the thing that's available to them as doctors. And I think that that's just amazing and beautiful, and it's the what should be happening, but because of the stuff that we're talking about, it just can't.
Can't yet, but I'm optimistic that maybe not by 2020, but I believe by 2030, we'll see it more integrated into modern medicine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, prior to its prohibition in the 1930s, cannabis was in the majority of patent medicines that were sold for a wide variety of conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And historically, humans have been using it since before recorded time.
Yes.
Treat everything, you know, seizures when we didn't quite understand what seizures were, to menstrual cramps.
Yeah, right. It's very interesting that you find. I was reading an article not too long ago about a water bong that was like found in an archaeological site in India that's like 4,000 years old and had, you know, cannabis resins detectable in it. And so we have, you know, when I talk to people about, you know, about changing the laws, they sometimes will say things like, well, you know, this thing's been illegal forever. And I'm like, well, you know, when you think about the entire history of human use of cannabis, the amount of time that it's been illegal is like a drop in the ocean.
Well, I absolutely. It is just a tiny drop in the ocean of human history.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that you mentioned that water bong, because one of my favorite things to bring up when I do presentations is to talk about a couple of years ago, they dug up a very well-preserved body of what they believed was a princess, a Yukat princess from Serbia.
Okay.
She's from like 2400 BCE. So mm-hmm. this is a very old body. And they found cannabis sealed up with her, and they found after they tested her body that she had breast cancer, and that they were likely using that to treat her breast cancer or the symptoms that went with it, you know, the pain and the wasting.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
So people before recorded history in that part of the world were using it to treat aggressive, debilitating conditions, and
yeah.
we're not allowed to these days.
Right, right. Yeah, and you know, even some of the, I was talking to some people in New York City this past weekend, and we were talking about they now have a medical marijuana law there, but it's like pretty restrictive, and it's limited only to like extracts, and it doesn't include whole flower, and there's like this very limited list of things that are considered like allowable illnesses to have to use medical marijuana. And, you know, when you think about that in the context of how medicine works in this country, the idea that the you know, state government is going to decide which medicine works for your condition and which doesn't, when you have, you know, when we have things like off-label prescription writing. So, you know, if a substance becomes approved by the FDA, then doctors can write prescriptions for that substance for whatever conditions they think that it works for. So it's the idea that not that in regards to cannabis, it's only going to be for these five things. And if you don't have one of those five things, then, you know, fuck you.
Yeah. It's very sad. I mean, it isn't just doctors. I'm not going to name names because I don't want to open you up to any legal liability, but you turn on your TV during prime time, there is a particular drug that they advertise for no less than four very disparate medical conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not approved as a drug for all four of those conditions initially, but now they advertise it for all of them.
Yeah, sure. And yeah, like, and you know, you have like Abilify.
Include brain, you know, brain infections and death.
Right.
And that is legal. But
right,
prescribing
exactly.
cannabis for a condition that isn't recognized by your state is illegal.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
bad.
Yes, indeed. So you said that Ladybud magazine is on hiatus. What's the situation with that?
Well, our illustrious leader and founder, Diane Thorndocker, has been going through some personal upheavals recently, and they moved their family from New Jersey and Pennsylvania area to Colorado because they were also dealing with Child Protective Services because her son, her younger son, talked about hemp, not even cannabis in a medical sense, but industrial hemp in school, and it ended up getting a case file open for their family. And
wow.
So there have been a lot of ups and downs involved with that move, and just currently we are on hiatus, although we do have articles slated to go, ready to go when publication starts again.
Right on.
And we have an amazing backlog of well over 1,000 articles, many of which are written by activists and, in some cases, nurse practitioners and scientists and sociologists that are accessible currently, even while new content isn't going up.
Right on. Cool. So
I recommend the site to anyone who's suffering from, you know, female-related medical issues, you know, like endometriosis or severe menstrual cramps, and to parents who need to kind of get a handle on what to expect. There's lots of articles by parents who've been investigated and who've had to fight either for their own personal use or for their child's access.
Mm-hmm. So a parent who is facing legal action, is under investigation, whose children have been questioned, what recommendation would you give to them? Obviously, we're not lawyers, but, you know, what do you think would be the first thing that they should do?
Well, the first thing they should do is lawyer up, unfortunately, even if it's just Child Protective Services. And to be careful to, if they can't afford an attorney, to at least do research before they have any sit-down meetings with the DHS CPS worker or with law enforcement to make sure that they're invoking their right to not implicate themselves when necessary.
Mm-hmm.
DHS and CPS workers specifically are very good at making themselves sound like they're your friend when really they're building a case to get your kid out of your house.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't necessarily say shut the door in the face of workers if they show up at your house, but you should be aware that anything you say, just like when you're talking to the police, can and very well may be used against you.
That's good advice.
Yes, be very careful about what you do say. And if you can't afford an attorney, I would recommend perhaps reaching out to the Family Law and Cannabis Alliance, which is based out of Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
They have a decent amount of resources as far as attorneys who have successfully represented cannabis cases in family court, and can also kind of help guide you through the process of dealing with DHS or CPS, whichever it is in the state that you're in.
Right on.
I think it's also important, too, that if your family is being investigated, especially if the children have been questioned or involved at any point, that you have a sit-down talk with your children about it. And we do have a Stinky Steve title specifically about this, Cannabis and Child Protective Services, which, again, we're happy to provide to people for free, at least in the digital form,
mm-hmm.
to help them have that conversation with their kids so that the children can understand that just because their family is being investigated does not mean their parents are bad parents and doesn't make their parents a criminal either.
Right, right. That's awesome.
Well, there's a lot of stigma that can go along with those sorts of investigations, and it can do a lot to undermine the trust in the child's parents from the child's perspective if you don't really understand what's going on.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about Stinky Steve. Maybe how he first came into your mind, and sort of what your inspiration was and what your writing process is like.
Well, Stinky Steve himself actually has been a character in my mind and in my life since I was 15, working as a counselor in training at a local Girl Scout camp. they had these, I know, it's silly, right? He wasn't cannabis related then. They had these floppy beanie plush toys, and they sold out of all of them, and none of the kids wanted the skunks, so they had several hundred skunks still. And I said, you know, I'm going to put him on my hat, and I'm going to wear him around. And so I walk around with a skunk on my head all the time, and we called him Stinky Steve, and when kids were very homesick, they could snuggle with Steve and tell him how they felt, and he was sort of like the stopgap for helping kids cope with their emotions and kind of tough it out to the end of camp.
Uh-huh.
And when we were running the dispensary and I got the idea for the books, it just kind of clicked in my head. This is the perfect place to put Stinky Steve, you know?
Yeah.
He's perfect. He's a skunk, which is culturally appropriate for the cannabis community.
Right.
He's friendly, and his whole focus, his whole existence is about helping kids feel better. And so that is sort of how Stinky Steve became the Stinky Steve of today. And as far as my writing process, it's relatively organic. I guess I decided I wanted it to rhyme, and I just kind of sat down and started, you know, doing a very basic rhyme scheme. And pretty soon I had several pages full, and we, you know, from there we ended up with 3 stanzas per page on 12 pages for the first book. And I just sort of followed that formula for the following titles.
And so the titles that you have that I've seen at least the original book, I've also seen the one about Grandma's Grow Room and Daddy's Dabs. We read that one. What do the other titles cover?
Okay. Well, the first one is Medical Marijuana, and then Daddy's Dabs, Mommy's Medibles, which talks about consumable forms of cannabis, including capsules, Grandma's Grow Room, Casual Cannabis, which is about recreational or non-medically certified use. And then after that, we have what I call the social titles, which focus more on the social repercussions of cannabis use. Stinky Steve explains cannabis and CPS, talking about why Child Protective Services might be involved with the family because of cannabis use or growth, being grown. And then Stinky Steve explains why Papa's in prison for pot is number 7, which is kind of a heartbreaking title for me. The fact that so many young parents are arrested and incarcerated and taken away from their children for cannabis is heartbreaking. And that title is meant to kind of be a touchstone for those children, to remind them that their parents aren't bad people just because they've been convicted of a nonviolent crime. And then the last title is Kids Who Use Cannabis, and that focuses on kind of helping lift the stigma for children who are using it for severe medical conditions.
Really cool. What kind of reactions or feedback have you gotten from the community or from other forms of media in regards to your books?
People are generally very positive about it. I think there's an acknowledgement that as this becomes more culturally prevalent and more socially acceptable, there is a real need to talk with children about it. And right now the titles are solely focused on children who already have it in their lives in one form or another because their loved ones are growing it or using it. We do have a 9th title that is not ready yet. We're still working with the illustrator. That will be more for like middle school age children, and it will be more blanket, as in not focusing just on families who use cannabis, but it's more broadly educational about what is this plant, why do people use it, and why isn't it a good idea for someone my age to use it unless I have a medical condition that necessitates.
Cool. What do you consider, if you could have your dream version of drug education for kids, what do you think that it would look like?
In general, like all drugs or cannabis specifically? That's a kind of a broad question.
Drugs in general, and maybe specifically cannabis as well. But we're one of the things we like to think about here is what does a, you know, post-prohibition world, what would it look like? And, you know, one of the things that we'd like to think a lot about is how would we like to see, you know, drug education generally changed and improved for our children and for our children's children. So, you know, what do you think drug education should be like?
Well, obviously we should move away from the criminalization model that is currently being used, that this is illegal and therefore it's bad. Or conversely, that it's bad and therefore it's illegal, and focus more on factual education. You know, we can sit kids down and say marijuana is bad, crack is bad, meth is bad. But when you group all of them together and you don't really get into the details, especially as the kids get out of grade school, they start saying, you know, they're going to call bullshit, basically.
Yes, exactly.
I hate the curse, but I don't know how else to phrase it succinctly.
Right.
Kids aren't stupid. Kids are smart. And I think that if you give them the information, if you say methamphetamine, for example, if we talk about its origins, you know, that it was developed as a cough depressant, mm-hmm. and that it was used as medicine before it became illegal, and that it is chemically similar to prescriptions that are currently given to underage children, mm-hmm. I think that's a much better way of talking to children about it mm-hmm. than just saying it's bad, don't do it. Because right. if you say that about all substances and they try cigarettes and they realize cigarettes aren't super evil and they try pot and their brain doesn't die and they get drunk once and they don't, you know, they don't crash their car because they don't make bad decisions, you know, then they start questioning all of it. And it makes it a very slippery slope as to, well, maybe meth isn't so bad. Maybe I'll right. just try that. And
right.
hey, you know, they said that Coke was bad, but they also said that weed was addictive. So maybe Coke's not that addictive. Mm-hmm. I'm not judging people who use cocaine recreationally, but it is definitely physically addictive.
Sure.
And so by separating them out more and being more factual in the way they're presented, I think we would do a much better job at deterring experimentation in more at-risk kids. And I hope, too, as time goes on, that kids are also taught about things like how to do it safely, as ridiculous as that may sound. Like, okay, if you're 15 and you're in health class and you're learning about alcohol, they should be learning about what is a toxic dose of alcohol when compared to your body weight.
Mm-hmm.
For safety's sake. And I would love to think that kids would eventually be taught about naloxone, too, because heroin and opiates are huge. And they're all over, and people often get started from medical prescriptions.
Right.
It would be nice if kids were not just taught opiates bad, but also, hey, there is a drug where if your friend is ODing, you can just administer it nasally, and you can zash them right back out of it.
Save their life, yeah.
So harm reduction. I would like to right. see more truth, and I would like to see harm reduction included in those educational processes.
Mm-hmm.
So that kids can make a good decision, or if they're going to make the experimental decision, which most kids do at one point or another, they can do so with good information and not just what they heard from their friends or saw in a movie.
Mm-hmm. And as a parent, you have a young child, and how old is your son?
He is 3.5. He'll be 4 this summer.
So as he gets... What's that?
He's a little young for the in-depth talks at this point.
Definitely, definitely. As he gets older, how do you plan to incrementally introduce him to these concepts?
Incrementally is the important part, right? It's start basic and slow. And I intend to do it the same way I've taught him about most other things that we have sit-down talks about. You know, tell him the most important points. And then let him lead the discussion. You know, what is he curious about? What does he want to know?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that may mean needing to come back to it later because I may not be able to give him an educated or factual answer mm-hmm. right when he asks it. So I may have to say, we're going to put a bookmark in this and come back to it on Sunday. but slowly, you know, I want him to know that drug use is either a personal decision or it is a health, you know, decision. It is not. It should not be a criminal thing.
Mm-hmm.
It is even people who are using the harder drugs, you know, because it stems from addiction, that is a medical thing. It does not make them criminals or bad people.
Mm-hmm.
But ideally, if you don't have a medical condition that necessitates it, I should hope that he will steer clear of those things until his brain is done growing.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big part of it for me, is making sure he understands I don't expect him to never try it. I want him to, when he does eventually experiment, do so in a safe and intelligent manner that reduces the possible risks associated with it.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not I want him binge drinking with his buddies in high school, it's probably going to happen at least once, statistically. You know?
Sure.
No matter how hard I crack down on him, he could get drunk during lunch at school if he wanted.
Yeah.
So... hopefully by that point we'll have worked our way up in the conversation to a point where he understands the risks of alcohol
uh-huh.
and also how to use it safely when he chooses to.
Well, I'll offer you a piece of hope is that the adult children of people that I talk to who are very out and open about their use of substances, the adult children of those people tend to be like pretty well-adjusted human beings, and many of them have used substances at a much later age than many of their peers. So I think, you know, being a person who is very, you know, based on facts and honest with their children is actually, you know, provides a protective factor to the kids and their upbringing. And, you know, there's always this sort of aspect of American culture when you're a kid is always about sort of like rebelling against mom and dad. So if like mom and dad are into cannabis, then it's not the cool thing to do to, like, you know, be edgy. Right. It's like, well, that's like dad does that. It's not cool to me.
Exactly. It's kind of like how they did. It was only a few points. Cannabis use actually dropped in Colorado after legalization. And I imagine it had something to do with teenagers being like, man, my parents are smoking weed. My grandma is smoking weed. This is not cool, man.
Right. Know? Exactly.
Like, we like to imagine that it's because the regulations made it harder for the kids to get their hands on it. But in reality, it probably has more to do with the decreased social stigma because it's no longer, as you pointed out, a rebellious thing to do.
One of the very hopeful and wonderful things that I've seen in the news about how decriminalization and legalization in the U.S. has changed the things is that it has taken a lot of power away from the Mexican drug cartels in terms of they aren't making as much money off of their cannabis in the States anymore because it's, you know, frankly terrible quality stuff and compared to the things that are being grown at home. And I remember when I was in high school and that awful Mexican stuff that had clearly been packed into a brick and smuggled across the border and it had full of seeds and like
rock and brown. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about, although I didn't do it in high school, but
but if you
that was definitely what was available for sale for the most part.
Yeah, and you compare that to the beautiful things that are being grown by, you know, local people now, and it's, yeah,
yes,
it's a
I
huge
agree.
Difference.
It's night and day.
But having that the power was taken away from those you know, criminal enterprises, and, you know, and now the profits are going to, like, regular people here in the States that are actually focused on healing and on, you know, the artisanal quality of growing their flowers. It's, I think that's great.
Well, I 100% agree with you on that. It's great that we're keeping it local and that people who are following state laws are the ones that are banking profits and not violent criminals. But I do want to point out on the other side of the coin is the fact that a lot of people who grow cannabis in Mexico aren't necessarily cartel members. Mm-hmm. They're working for the cartels in many cases because their family could no longer make a profit growing corn after NAFTA.
Ah, interesting.
You know, there was a huge, if you look statistically, there's a huge boom in cartel expansion and cannabis production in Mexico in the years immediately following NAFTA. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that the U.S. can export corn at below the cost of production because of federal corn subsidies. And corn is a major staple of the Mexican diet. Mm-hmm. And a lot of subsistence farmers down there grew it, and it was, you know, one or their only source of income.
Mm-hmm.
And when they could no longer compete and sell it on the market, they had to immediately turn to something else that could be grown with few inputs and turn a good profit. And what could they really, what options did they have?
Mm-hmm.
Not many. So
yeah.
While we're talking about, you know, helping those cartels dry up, I think we also need to be looking at the country folk and the farmers who are providing to the cartels and saying, what can we do to help them preserve their communities and their culture and protect their families so that they don't have to turn to the cartels and, heaven forbid, start growing poppies or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, speaking of poppies, there's a similar sort of pattern that you see in Afghanistan when, there was a huge ramp up in opium production in Afghanistan in the 1980s after the sort of proxy war between the United States and the Soviet Union. And then all poppy production was halted under the Taliban. And now that the U.S. has been in there for over a decade, now the Afghanistan's providing like over 80% of the opium on the black market that becomes heroin. So it's an interesting thing that we sort of position ourselves as like the country that's against drugs, but you know, there's drugs being produced right under our noses in this particular situation.
We're one of the biggest consumers of drugs, you know. I mean,
right?
Marijuana, opium, it all comes to us. We are major consumers when it comes to drugs. And
yeah,
you know, the opium thing and the heroin thing is also rooted in our anti-drug culture that you just referenced. Because we got many people hooked on pills, you know, like Oxycontin, and then we reformulated them. Our drug companies reformulated these drugs to decrease their abuse, forcing all those people who were addicted onto the black market looking for heroin.
Interesting. Yeah, and I've heard a lot too about just in the last couple of years as the DEA has sort of cracked down on, you know, prescription mill doctors and things like that, that has also driven people into the black market for heroin because their doctor can't write them a script for their Oxycontin anymore or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really starting to hit home for a lot of people because, you know, these people addicted to heroin are no longer the other. They're no longer this, you know, the original opium craze or opium fear came from the evil Chinamen smoking their opium, you know?
Right.
And then after that, the other was, you know, poor people in the inner city using it. And
right.
It was never, and now it's in middle America and it's in upper class, middle class, working class homes. It's everywhere.
Yeah.
And so clearly just saying it's bad and trying to attach stigma, racial or otherwise, to it has done nothing to combat its use.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things that cannabis is good for is, you know, I know many people who had serious drinking problems who have been able to stop drinking and, you know, they've switched from, you know, drinking a whole bottle of wine or a fifth of vodka every night to just a couple of puffs of cannabis. And that's all they really need to sort of feel relaxed and keep them off of something that's far more harmful to their health and makes them depressed and angry and possibly violent. And so, you know, that's another thing that cannabis can help with.
Yes. Instead of calling it a gateway drug, some people have taken to calling it an exit drug. And I think that is very accurate. We actually saw regularly 5 or 6 women from the local methadone clinic who were trying to get off methadone, and they received their medical cannabis cards and would come into our shop and would get cannabis to kind of help them stave off their craving.
Mm-hmm.
It takes away the worst of their withdrawal.
And yeah.
If medical professionals and law enforcement would view it the same way as something that could help people with worse addictions instead of as the way they got those addictions, which
sure.
has no basis in science.
Yes. And, you know, we also are fighting against the, you know, the like AA and the whole like 12-step thing in this country. Kind of, they sort of have a corner on the market for rehab and getting off of, you know, different things. But I think like AA has like functionally about a 5% success rate. And it's sort of, yeah, it sort of corners itself on the idea that, like, if you aren't successful in AA, it's your fault, not the fault of the system. But we have, you know, medicines out there that can Ibogaine, for example, that can have, you know, almost miraculous abilities to get people off of opiates. And I mean, I personally, so I had an 8-year alcohol addiction that was, I mean, I don't know if I would call it cured, but I went from, you know, having to get drunk every day to zero, just no, I had no cravings after I drank ayahuasca for the first time. So, you know,
ayahuasca is incredibly useful for people both with addiction and with other forms of psychotherapy, like trauma, healing from trauma as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it's borderline criminal that it's not accessible to people who need it in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. And it's, you know, I think that I'm very hopeful about things like the work that MAPS is doing with MDMA therapy, the studies that are going on right now in many different places using psilocybin. I think that there's the window has been reopened to these different, these alternative medicines. And you know, I attribute the work that people have done in cannabis activism to opening the door and doing the really, really hard stuff that has been done in the last, you know, 15, 20 years, within medical cannabis, because that, friends and I joke that, you know, that cannabis kind of is the gateway drug, but it's been the gateway to making people, you know, think differently about these things that they have been told for, you know, decades and decades are awful things for you. And the work that people have done in the cannabis activist community has really made it easier for those of us who are trying to argue for the positives of other substances to, you know, get our foot in the door. Like, people listen to us because they can see. One of the things that Rick Doblin said at a conversation, or it was at Horizons conference last fall. He said that the reason why people's attitudes have changed about cannabis so quickly is because they have seen people who are their mother, their grandmother, their uncle, and they've seen that what the cannabis really can help people. And that has just radically changed people's attitudes. And even people who don't care about cannabis, are never going to smoke cannabis, they know someone whose life has been positively changed because of this plant. And so they're much less susceptible to the negative propaganda about cannabis and even about other drugs as well.
I agree. And I think there's a big overlap between activists who fight for cannabis and those who are advocating for other substances too. Initially, when medical marijuana was first starting to become a thing in the 90s, it started with California, it took a lot of courage for people to speak up and say, I use it for medical purposes, because mm-hmm. they were admitting to a federal offense for a Schedule One substance.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, after the first couple hundred, you know, then thousands more have been willing to step up in the decades since. And now people are also saying, well, hey, hold on. You know, DMT, like you said, really helped me. And MDMA guided therapy really helped me. And why mm-hmm. aren't we talking about these things in
mm-hmm.
our culture?
Yeah. Right.
Possibly uses these substances that our government says have no medical value whatsoever, when in fact they do.
Right. Yeah. So, this past weekend, I heard, I went to an event called Psychedelic Storytelling, where people talked about their experiences with psychedelics and how they made them better. And the mother of a friend of mine went up on stage and she talked about how having an MDMA therapy session was able for her to like release a lot of her frustration, anger and her pain around being sexually abused as a child.
Yes, MDMA therapy seems to be incredibly effective. You know, I've read people saying it can be the equivalent of 3 to 5 years of therapy in 1 to 3 8-hour sessions. You know?
Yeah.
Especially people who have complex trauma backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
Diane Formbacher from Ladybud is an excellent example, although she has not done, to my knowledge, MDMA therapy. She advocates for it and longs for the day when it will be legal because of its reputation for being excellent at helping people work to the roots of their trauma. You know, she's been very public about her childhood traumas and how cannabis has helped her cope with that. But she is also very much looking toward the future to the legalization of psychedelic enhanced therapy to help her better process instead of just treating the symptoms, which is really how cannabis works for people with trauma conditions. More mm-hmm. about, you know, stopping the, you know, your breakdown if you've been triggered and you have PTSD. It's about getting you out of that anxious or suicidal brain space and into a calmer place until you're, you know, able to just kind of handle life again.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas MDMA-assisted psychotherapy can actually help you work to the point where you're no longer having those triggered moments anymore,
mm-hmm.
in theory.
Yeah. One of the hopeful things that has happened in the last, I don't know what, year and a half or so, is that the VA, while not allowing their, you know, Michigan-based doctors to prescribe cannabis to vets, they are no longer like required to report if someone is using cannabis. They can, a vet will not lose their benefits in Michigan if they test positive for cannabis and are using it under a doctor's care. So, you know, I do see those kinds of things that are hopeful.
Yes, I agree that it's very hopeful, you know, and a lot of that I think stems from Susan Sisley's map-stated actually research on military PTSD and cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
And right now in the country that we know of, and most veterans argue that it's underreported because it doesn't take into account people who kill themselves with substances without leaving a note or intentional automobile accidents.
Mm-hmm.
But 22 veterans a day commit suicide.
Yeah.
Right now, which is just an appalling statistic.
Indeed.
And cannabis, that it in states where cannabis has been legalized or is available to medical patients with PTSD specifically, suicide rates drop substantially.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's definitely something that hopefully the VA will catch on to on a national level soon.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, you know, I really applaud the strategy of MAPS for really focusing on that specific group of people. Number one, most importantly, is because of exactly what you said. Like, if there's something that can help these people now to be better psychologically and to, you know, like leave the battlefield mentally, that's huge, you know. And that's, and also the fact that military personnel are very well respected members of our community, and for military personnel to be saying, like, you know, MDMA changed my life, that's a huge thing in terms of shifting the culture.
I agree, although I would say as a feminist and as someone who writes for a feminist publication, that mm-hmm. that there's a bit of a patriarchy, not necessarily in you, but in our culture, and that's where we focus is on veterans. And I have mm-hmm. the utmost respect for people who have served, even if I don't necessarily support the wars that they've fought in. I support their decision to try to do what they felt was the best thing,
mm-hmm.
You know, the patriotic thing, the right thing. I absolutely support them, and I believe that our veterans deserve excellent health care and good benefits when they come home,
mm-hmm.
especially if they come back with PTSD. But the most substantial group of people with PTSD in this country is not veterans.
Mm-hmm.
It's women and victims of childhood abuse and sexual abuse. And that comprises as many as one out of three people. And some studies indicate that it's the same with men, only men are even less likely than women to report sexual trauma and childhood
mm-hmm.
abuse.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a huge, huge amount of our population walking around with mental health conditions that aren't acknowledged.
Yeah.
And they don't get the respect they deserve because they're women or because they were a child when it happened, or heaven forbid, they were a man who was raped by a woman, because no one even thinks that's physically possible.
Mm-hmm.
I've interviewed men who've been raped by women. It is definitely possible, and it is very traumatizing for them. And they can't speak up about it because our culture mocks them or ignores them.
Yeah. I mean, like, if you just look at the difference in the way that the media covers, say, like a teacher being inappropriate with a student, when it's like when the teacher is a woman versus when the teacher is a man, if you look at the way that the media covers those two things so radically differently, it's appalling. Like, in either situation, you're talking about a minor.
Yeah. Well, you know, they say the first rule of mental health on the internet is never read the comments. But as someone who wants to understand the average person, I often delve into the comments section knowing I'm going to see some of the worst of humanity there. And, you know, when it is a male victim and a female teacher, there is a disturbing amount of male responders who will say things like, "Where was she when I was in high school?" And,
sure, yeah.
You know, they may think they're being funny, but they are minimalizing this person's trauma and also marginalizing a substantial group of people who've been through something horrific
mm-hmm.
that in all likelihood is going to affect them for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. Yeah.
Here in Michigan, when PTSD was being considered to be added to the medical marijuana law, because it was not in the language when the bill was initially passed in 2008, mm-hmm. so there were hearings at the state level about it, veterans actually tried to block female survivors of domestic abuse and sexual assault from testifying, and they wanted the law to only apply to veterans because they thought it would definitely pass if veterans were were the focus, and that women being included decreased their likelihood of it being passed. And
I'm not saying the veterans
are doing that out of sexism. I think they were being pragmatic. Thankfully, they didn't win that argument, and eventually it did pass for all people with PTSD. But how? What a sad thing about our culture that these veterans who were desperate for medication were like, we're worried that the only way we're going to get access is if we don't include everyone who needs it because people don't take you seriously.
Wow. That's really disturbing. It's incredibly disturbing.
It is. And again, I'm not saying that any of those veterans were sexist or that they had anything against the women who were testifying. I don't believe that to be true. In fact, one of them is married to one of the most amazing female activists in the state, or maybe not married, but in a relationship with her. And I know for a fact he's not a sexist. He's an amazing guy. So I'm not trying to say that that's an indictment of them as people. It's an indictment of us as a culture and us as a state that the trauma of women and children matters less to us than that of our veterans.
Sure, yeah.
I do think they're making a lot of progress on that front, though, just like with the drug war and with things like LGBT acceptance. You know, social media and interconnectivity has had a lot to do with that. You know, 10 years ago, I couldn't have told you, in fact, when I wrote the first edition of Stinky Steve, I wouldn't have been able to tell you the name of a single kid who had a condition that required cannabis. And I met a child, actually, about 2 months after we first published the first edition of Stinky Steve. And I actually rewrote several pages and several stanzas of the book because before I used very strict and harsh language talking about why kids should not ever use cannabis. And then I met this little boy who had this terrible kidney condition and who was using cannabis in conjunction with pharmaceuticals to help. And it just, it really changed my perspective. Very drastically. Like I said, it's the size of the children. I often joke, you know, that I'm kind of like Mrs. Lovejoy from The Simpsons, you know, well, think of the children. You know, it's like the exact opposite of Nancy Reagan, though. Like, think of the children and make it illegal. It's more like, think of the children and how the way you're behaving is not actually helping them.
Right.
Making it worse for them.
Yeah. And you know, this idea of, like, we need to protect kids from all these evil things is, it gets in the way of, you know, us as a society growing in some ways. It's used as a, you know, blunt object that beats people into submission. And, you know, the thing that when I talk about the work that I'm doing, the thing that people immediately say is like, well, what about CPS or what about your kids being taken away? And, you know, I, you know, that sometimes I think about that and it is like a pretty scary concept. But at the same time, you know, somebody at some point has to be the person that's going to just stand up and say, like, this is ridiculous shit. Like, I am a normal human being. I function in society. I pay my taxes. I live my life. I'm a good person. I, you know, I take care of the poor and I give money at church and I'm a good parent. Yeah. And, you know, the fact that I have had life transformative experiences because of psychedelics and I'm not afraid to talk about it doesn't suddenly make me a bad parent.
No, absolutely. In fact, it arguably makes you a better parent because you're willing to be open and honest about what was helpful to you and what might help make the world a little bit saner and healthier for your children when they're older.
Yeah, there was a great article, I don't know if you saw it in on Jezebel just the other day that I saw, that it's the title of it was, it's a lot more fun to play make-believe with your kids if you're a little bit high on weed.
I can see that. I know I read a piece on Offbeat Parenting years ago where the mom was talking about how her daughter was obsessed with Candyland and that after about three times, unless she was high, she was done. But if she had a little bit of smoke beforehand, it made it a lot easier to deal with playing 18 consecutive rounds of Candyland, you know?
Boring and annoying. I can totally agree with that.
No matter how much you love your kids, you know, after an hour and a half of Candyland, you're just like, oh my God, the molasses pit again. You know?
Oh, that is funny. So as we're getting close to the end here, but I did want to ask you one more question before we go. And the question I'd like to ask you is, as someone who is out there being an activist in cannabis, how do you interact with, say, other people in the life of your son? And do the other people know about the work that you do? And if they do, how do you talk about it with like real people as opposed to just, you know, people on the internet?
Well, that's a great question, actually. I feel like with anything in life, you have to pick your battles. So, for example, when my son went to have his speech evaluated at the local grade school, mm-hmm. I did not show up in a pot leaf t-shirt. And I did not talk about my activism with the teachers, you know, mm-hmm. who might incorrectly correlate, you know, his verbal delay with cannabis exposure, which he has not had, mm-hmm. Instead of with, you know, emotional responses to his parents separating, which is mm-hmm. obviously very impactful when you're 3 years old.
Right.
So it's about picking and choosing, you know, like you don't need to necessarily be telling every single person, especially those who are in a position of authority over you about mm-hmm. your advocacy mm-hmm. or your medical use. But on a social level, I'll talk to just about anybody about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a very chatty person. And if I start talking to someone in the checkout line from the supermarket and they mention that they've got rheumatoid arthritis, I will tell them, oh, you know, cannabis works great. And if you don't like to smoke it and you don't like the idea of eating it because you've read about people overdosing when they eat it, you should look into topical creams, which can be very helpful for people with inflammatory pain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just kind of opening the door to the idea that this isn't just something teenagers do to get high. This is right. something that a 75-year-old woman can do to help with her medical condition.
Yeah. Yes. My friend Lex Pelger says that the route to cannabis acceptance is to, you know, get your grandmother to be using it to treat her rheumatoid and her keep her memory sharp and all those sorts of things that it's great for. He's like, I'm always advocating like, grandmas need weed, and then people will be okay with it.
There's actually a group called Grannies for Grass, and it's just a kind of a personal anecdote. My maternal grandmother, years ago, my grandfather accidentally backed over her with a pickup truck when they were in their 70s and trying to put in a window-mounted air conditioner. He broke all of her ribs, he punctured her lung, you know, and so he's now got very severe pain from this.
Yeah.
And one of the things I learned to do when we had a dispensary was to make a topical cream, mm-hmm. not from the actual buds or the psychoactive part, but from the root. So there's no psychoactive properties and no controlled substances in it, but it still mm-hmm. helps in the patient.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandma was of that generation where we couldn't explain it to her because she would just say, oh, cannabis bad.
mm-hmm.
But darned if she does not use that lotion and swears it's the only thing that works.
Awesome.
So, you know, I agree that if we get enough of the grannies involved, it can make a big difference. Even if you maybe can't tell the grandma directly, I can say for a fact that my grandmother has had a positive response to it. Mm-hmm. You might, if you haven't talked to him yet, be interested in reaching out to Robert Blatchard from the Silver Tour down in Florida. He specifically goes out and talks to senior citizens in Florida about the various ways that cannabis can help with medical conditions that crop up when you age.
Right on. Yeah. Cool. Thank you for that. Well, Maggie, I want to say thank you for being on the show. I want to say that I am very happy to be finding more parent activists in the Mitten State. And I'm sure that we will be seeing each other very soon.
I look forward to it, and I just want to say you need to keep doing what you're doing because you're giving a voice to a far too quiet group of people who definitely deserve mainstream representation in our culture.
Right on. Thank you so much. Have a great night.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye.